Welcome, everyone, back to the Brocast. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 24/7 Sports Network, and I am joined on this fine Friday morning, this action-packed Friday, by Tracy Pearson. Tracy, how are you?
I'm good, Dave. You?
Just ready for the action. That's
freaky packed. Friday, dude.
Yeah, it's a freaky Friday. It's the second
two in a row.
Yeah.
It's really weird.
At least knee-high and not something good.
Everyone asked the question, why is this happening? Why, you know, it's scheduling stuff. You know, they'd like to put the Lehigh game on Saturday, but there's a volleyball game. Yep. They can't just say, hey, you know, get out of here, volleyball. So,
I mean, why is this happening is such a good question. I mean, it really depends on your worldview, probably how you approach religion. Like, if you're a Buddhist, why is this happening? Maybe something you did in a former life. Have you ever considered that?
Just the scheduling.
Yeah. Why is this happening?
Should we take more from what you're saying, Dave, about why this is happening?
Just okay. UCLA scheduling.
Okay.
Why is this happening? Because of something you did. Maybe not you, but your soul, your entity in a previous life.
Just you know, we do that crap a lot. Like you and I will say, hey, don't talk about that. Like for the first half or something. But we all know. Mm-hmm. Nothing that we do or talk about impacts what happens on the field or on the court. Unless it does. Why have we had this conversation before?
You never know. We got a lot to talk about though today. So we're going to cut to the chase. There's some news, there's some games, and there's some recruiting stuff. We're going to start with the news. UCLA Athletic Director Martin Jarman's extension was revealed yesterday. The reason I term it that way is apparently this thing was agreed to by outgoing Chancellor Gene Block in spring, and UCLA released it now. I don't know if that's contract approval stuff through the Regents or if it's trying to time it appropriately with the ebbs and flows of athletic schedule.
The upswing of football.
Maybe.
As opposed to when they were 1-5, maybe.
But the details of the extension, no salary details, except that the extension is through 2029. His previous contract was set to expire, was it next summer? Summer after that?
End of 2025. End of next school year, I think.
Yeah. So Martin Jarman extended. I know on our message board, I would say the 90% response was negativity. I'll just say this. I think a lot of your opinion about Jarmond depends in a huge amount on whether two things. Whether first you think the Big Ten was a positive move, and second, whether you think Martin Jarman had a lot to do with it or not. I would say from a football hiring, firing, and basketball hiring, firing standpoint, first, he's got an incomplete in basketball because he hasn't needed to do anything. Mick Cronin's doing fine. Football, he made a huge, huge mistake in not firing Chip Kelly in November. Not doing that. For me, when I'm assessing athletic directors, I'm looking at it from a user side. I'm not looking at it from, administrative, like, does he balance the budget? I don't care. But user side, what you're looking at is hiring and firing, apparel deals, and big macro moves that affect the direction of the program. I'm not a big fan of the Big Ten move. The Jordan Brand deal is mostly cashless. Which is a rarity in FBS football these days. And on top of that, missing the window to fire Chip Kelly is a big, big problem. So that's my general assessment of the athletic department and athletic director.
And you'd say that the hiring of Deshaun Foster, the jury's still out.
Yeah, jury's out. And
I mean, overall, you would say that that was a long shot of a hire, though.
I would call it, you don't judge results right now. I would like it to work out for Deshaun Foster. He's an alum.
Absolutely.
He's so many things about it. I would like it to work out. The process was horrible. The process starting in November when you didn't fire Chip Kelly continuing on through, you know, a 72-hour process where, again, if you're setting a deadline of 72 hours, you probably have a pretty good idea of who you're going to end up with. So, you know, it felt a little farcical in the time, but I would like it very much to work out for Deshaun Foster. But I think if you're judging the process, you have to call that.
Yeah, you know, the processes are always crazy. I mean, I think what you got to do, it's not a stretch to say it was a long probability hire. I mean, if it turns out, good on him, great call that it turned out. You saw something that a lot of other people didn't, but it was a long shot of a hire. That doesn't mean it won't happen. That just means it was an out of the box long shot hire.
Agreed. And so where it stands right now is he has an extension. Reportedly, according to UCLA's own release, this was agreed to by Chancellor Block. Julio Frank doesn't start until January. Now, I can't imagine UCLA is doing all of this without any sort of advice and consent from the incoming chancellor, but, you know, it'll be interesting to see, you know, what that relationship builds into once Frank is in charge in full in January.
I think the athletic, it's a whole new area in college sports. The athletic director has to be judged on really simply mostly two things: the success of your football program, and that's probably at UCLA, it's probably less because of UCLA's basketball program, but that's probably 65% of it, and the football program and the basketball program 35%, right? So the jury's still out on whether he can oversee a successful football program.
Yeah.
There have been some missteps in this era right now to be successful. And even though the whole revenue sharing, we've been discussing that endlessly on the forum, what it's been for the last few years has been NIL. No matter what it took to get that done, to be a successful football program, you needed to generate a lot of NIL. And I'd say right now, Martin Jarman, well, I'd say the athletic department was behind in being able to adapt to helping the program generate NIL. They're kind of in a transition period now. But I'm not even going to get later. I won't even get into details, really. I'll just say, did the athletic director facilitate an NIL situation that was conducive for UCLA football to be successful?
Yeah.
That's what it stands on now.
Let me go through the popular vote here, because I have I posted a straight news story yesterday about Jarman being retained. It has 9 upvotes and 127 downvotes on the Bruin Report online message board. Negative 118. That is my most downvoted post of all time.
Wow. Wow. I don't want to end this necessarily on, it looks like we're, you know, just piling on against Martin Jarman. The basic thing here is right now I think he's got a challenge at the UCLA athletic department with the debt and where the football program is. We're not saying it's over and it's done. He has a chance, and that's where it stands at this moment.
There you go.
You've got to make a successful program out of that football program. And that's not year in and year out, 7 wins. That's 9 plus wins. And occasionally you get the 10 or 11 and you're going to be, you know, top 20 on average every year. That's what UCLA football should be.
Yeah, it should
make
be a top
make that happen. Program. Make that
top
happen. 20,
a top 25 program doesn't mean you are literally top 25 every single year, but it means some years you're, you know, hovering in the top 15, some years you're out, and most of the years you're, you know, pretty comfortably a ranked team much of the year.
I would expect now with the college football playoffs, I would expect UCLA to get in the college football playoffs once every 4 or 5 years. It should be top 12, Dave. Like what you're saying, if it's 27 one year, the next year to balance that out to be top 20, it should be the 12th ranked team in the country.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is like 8 or 9 spots are just sewn up by certain programs every single year. Because well, that's a conversation.
It should be competing to be in the college football playoff.
It should have a chance of making the college football playoff, which hasn't happened since 2013. Like, there should be a realistic chance going into many years that UCLA has a chance to make the college football playoff. That hasn't been true. And it hasn't been true that UCLA would have had a chance to finish in the top 12 for any year except 2022 in the last decade. So that needs to change. Thinking that that is UCLA's standard is, I think, one of the problems that this athletic department needs to get past.
Yeah.
So we'll see where they end up on that. But we have games to talk about too. The football program, which, you know, we just described, this thing very tied, I think, to Martin Jarman's future at UCLA, has surged of late. Last week against Iowa, played, you know, it's now like 3 weeks in a row where we keep saying they played their best game of the year. They played their best game of the year. And then Iowa again, I think, was another example of their best game of the year, because it had to, UCLA had to overcome the turnover bugaboo against a team that generally, if you turn it over against them a bunch, they're going to kill you. And they didn't. And UCLA stopped them at their own game. They stopped the run. They forced them into turnovers, which is not something that is always happening to Iowa. And on the other side of the ball, they ran it down their throats. It was, you know, playing at a different speed. It was playing at a different, as Mick Cronin talks about, dancing to a different tune. And they were able to do that and win a pretty convincing 20-17 game at home. And now they go into Washington, which is a 5-5 team in desperate need of a sixth win to get to bowl eligibility. They're probably not going to get it next week against Oregon, so they have to get it tonight. Tracy.
Yes, Dave. Iowa game for me, easily the best performance by UCLA this season. A legit opponent. I mean, we could retroactively look back on Nebraska and say, they weren't. I mean, look at their record. Look who they beat. Definitely Rutgers. Iowa is a solid team.
They blew out Wisconsin the previous week.
We always do this where we say every team UCLA is beaten, we start to find things that were wrong with it. And they're a one-dimensional offense. They don't have a very great quarterback. So I'll say that. But the breakthrough here last week, which made UCLA, I mean, in my mind, in that game, a good team, was that it was able to run. It ran for over 200 yards. I mean, it hasn't done that yet this season. So I hope that's not an aberration and that is actually a breakthrough. Because Iowa is not a bad defensive team. They're pretty decent against the run. So that's where we all, up until this point, even when they play good games, they were scheming and playing around the fact that they couldn't run the ball. They actually ran the ball well. So it was a full-fledged game last week against Iowa. Washington is just a strange team. They're so inconsistent on both sides of the ball. Statistically, there are some things where they look really good. Then there are some things like within those statistics where they're pretty bad. This is another team that has questions at quarterback.
Yes.
You and I have been talking even before he got pulled. We've been talking about Rodgers just not being very good. And I've watched Washington a lot just because they're Washington. You know, they're one of the Pac-12 four in the Big Ten, but also because of, you know, Jed Fish. Jed Fish came up to me at a local bar here in Westlake like about 6 years ago. I was just sitting there when he was working for the Rams and said, "Hey, Tracy." So just because of that, I'm still a Jed Fish fan. So I've been watching him closely. I know you've been watching every game. That quarterback situation, I mean, I didn't want to just come to that conclusion so quickly, but he ain't good. Damon Williams, I've seen him play since he was going to be a junior in high school. Saw him at a bunch of camps. To me, this was, remember Bryce Young when he was hitting big at Arizona at Alabama, when all the college coaches were thinking it was a trend that they were going to get kind of an undersized mobile quarterback. And Damon Williams kind of benefited from that. I sat back and watched him at that camp, and I thought he couldn't throw the ball further than 30 yards. And we were being told all these offers were coming in. So I've never gotten it. He's very mobile. But I think, as you wrote, he or I think maybe it was a mock over. I'm getting you guys mixed up, Dave. That he runs the vast majority of his snaps, he'll end up running the ball.
Yeah, it was mock over.
Amazing. So I think it's hard because Washington is a weird team. Like I said, really inconsistent and in trying to get a read on them. But it's another team where they just have not had great quarterback play.
Well, and beyond that, Jed Fish has been, I would say, borderline David Shaw-esque in the red zone this year, just getting galaxy-brained and doing some extremely stupid things. He's not a good game manager, and he's been very, very poor at turning their decently efficient offense into points. And some of that is quarterback play. Some of it is, short yardage runs have not been super successful for them. But a lot of it is just harebrained stuff in the red zone. I mean, there was the short field option or the short side option that he attempted on the goal line. I think that was against Washington State, which was just dumb. It was dumb in the moment. It was dumb in reality. There's just stupid things he's doing. Even at the end of the USC game where they won, he decided on a 3rd-and-1 to ice the game. Instead of having Will Rogers just continue to hand off, he brought in Damon Williams, and they got a penalty for 12 men on the field. Like, he's doing stupid things. And so I think that's inhibiting Washington to an extent. He's not a great game manager. He's a good recruiter, good system guy, not a great game manager. So offensively, they really struggle to score. They're really good at moving the ball. They're really, really struggling to score.
I would watching their game, you say, wow, like if you're watching a few different games, you're watching them and you're saying, wow, they're moving the ball. And then you click away and you click back and go, they still haven't scored.
No. And they turn it over. They miss kicks. They do lots of weird stuff in the end zone, in the red zone. And then defensively, this is a horrible run defense. And probably one of the very best pass defenses UCLA has played.
Yeah. So the way I look at this, UCLA beat Iowa despite the turnovers. I mean, they left altogether 13 to 21 points that would have been added to the margin between UCLA and Iowa last week. They've beaten teams without a running game. They're going to, at Washington, always a tough place to play, even though UCLA has been really good on the road this year. They're going to need all of it. They're going to need that running game, which you might be able to say they'll be able to run against Washington because they don't have a good rushing defense. But Ethan Garbers is going to have to not commit those errors and those turnovers. UCLA will have to play error-free ball and be able to run. And I think if they do that, they'll win.
I agree. The wild card is just like if they suddenly do figure some things out in the red zone. There's also a lot of soft factors that favor Washington. First, the game matters more to them. I know it sounds crazy to say that, but UCLA can still build a bowl picture without this win. Washington can't. They're not beating Oregon next week. So they need this win. It's Friday night. Friday night road games have not generally been kind to anyone. It's a blackout game for Washington. Fans will probably be going crazy.
Senior night.
And it's senior night. So there's a lot of the soft stuff that's trending Washington's way. I'll just say UCLA is kind of improving in each game at this point. And that doesn't mean, progress isn't linear, yada, yada, yada. That doesn't mean they're suddenly going to like be gangbusters in this game. But Deshaun Foster is kind of growing incrementally as a game management guy. You got to remember, these are his first reps as a head coach. And so some of the stuff that looked pretty wonky at the beginning of the season is looking a little bit better now. I would still like a little bit more math on fourth down and timeout usage, but that's improving too. So there's, I don't know. I think it's going to be a very close game. I predicted UCLA to win. It could go the other way, but I don't think it's going to be, I don't think either team is going to be scoring in the 30s. I think it's going to be a low scoring, pretty close game.
The thing about UCLA too, we have always been citing those soft factors in just about every game, and they're pretty much impervious to them this year.
Yeah.
I mean, playing away, it has not fazed them at all.
No.
So when it comes to getting motivated for a bowl game, I don't, maybe that might motivate Washington more, but I think that's just in a silo of Washington compared to, does it have any impact on the mentality of UCLA playing that game at Washington tonight? No.
Yeah.
The way this team is, they just play hard no matter where they are, and they completely impervious to all of those kind of soft factors. So it's going to be a really interesting game. You know, we do this a lot with watching UCLA football where we think it's kind of a breakthrough game. And, you know, there's a history here going back many, many years of us walking up to the doorstep of that breakthrough game and then the door getting slammed on all of our faces. It would be nice, right? Wouldn't it be nice? From a pure, not analytical standpoint, just from an emotional standpoint, wouldn't this be nice?
It would be, I think it would be lovely to consider the possibilities of being 5-5 heading into that USC game, knowing that winning that one, your likelihood of finishing with a winning season, with a winning record in this year where they started 1-5, I think that would tip a lot of the scales in favor of UCLA in that game a week from now.
Yeah. And then, yeah.
So I think there's a lot, there is a lot, I think, emotionally riding on this game for UCLA. I do think that factors in too, but yeah, I mean, it's you know, we've talked a lot about it, but Minnesota now, it's just, it comes even harsher focus, that game and that result. Yeah. Where it's just, they would be 5-4 right now,
and we had said that would be like the most important game of the year,
so they would be 5-4 right now. They would be looking at a 3-game stretch of all winnable games, but certainly one more winnable than the other two, and knowing, okay, we've got a bowl game in our back pocket. And maybe that makes you a little bit more complacent or not, but that one, the winning in this game, I think puts them, they've broken serve on our preseason projection for them. And it will have been, you know, that's a thing that it kind of erases the mistake of that Minnesota game, which would be huge.
And then if we're talking about just non-analytics, but just how you feel, I mean, I know all UCLA fans, we're just tired of watching that. And I know this means almost nothing of listening to the national media and UCLA's either talked about negatively or not talked about at all. It would be really cool if UCLA started out 1-5, and then went 6-0 or even 5-1 to finish off its season and get bowl eligible. It would be one of the stories of college football this year. It would be really nice for UCLA to be one of the stories of college football in the offseason. That would be really something that, you know, would be really nice just to experience. And then talking about how that would impact recruiting and transfer portal recruiting. Someone asked me, a bunch of people asked me this week. I think the momentum and the sentiment right now is all good enough to recruit pretty strongly.
Yeah.
I think the program has that right now. What it needs is NIL. And we, you know, I got in kind of deep on that story. UCLA is going to need to generate a lot of money, like at probably double of what it has for this year's team, just to get the equivalent talent of this year's team for next year. So it's got a challenge ahead of it. You and I talked about this, and then I wrote about it. You know, the way NIL deals work, you make the, let's say it's a transfer guy. You agree on the NIL deal in December, in January. It doesn't actually kick in until that player is enrolled, and then it comes in installments. So many programs do this that they kind of cut NIL deals for money they don't necessarily have at the time. A lot of businesses do this too. UCLA is so conservative, it hasn't done it really that much in the past on so many different levels, but especially on this. I'd say maybe stretch it a little for some key transfers, not across the board on every transfer, but for some key guys that you recognize and identify as guys you really need and really want to improve the talent level from this year to next year. Cut a bigger deal, find the money later. Right, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's risks involved with doing that, obviously. I think you need to be backstopped by somebody who's like a guarantor. But making deals without like all the cash in hand, I don't think is the end of the world if you're doing installment deals. If you have a pretty good idea that you're going to be able to fundraise via X, Y, and Z events. I just, the thing to be careful of is to make sure you're backstopped. Make sure there is somebody at the end of the day who can cut a check, who's, you know, willing to do that if you don't quite meet your fundraising goals. Because the worst thing would be to have a PR nightmare on the order of, you know, what happened with Florida and Jaden Rashada or something like that. So
sure, a backstop guy, and you continue to raise money, but a backstop guy to make up the difference.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, I think being more aggressive than they have been, I think would be fine. I think there's a lot of wiggle room between being a, you know, what Florida was trying to do 2 years ago and, you know, where UCLA is right now. I think there's a lot of area for UCLA to move to a little bit more of an aggressive position for sure. Basketball also plays tonight, Tracy. They're playing something called Lehigh.
Do you know where Lehigh is?
They're in the Patriot League.
Yeah, I'm talking geographically. I did not know. I don't make it sound like I know what the hell I'm talking about. It feels like
Massachusetts or Pennsylvania.
It is Pennsylvania. If you can come up with the town. I forgot the town from yesterday. That would have been a trick question. No, it is not.
Bethlehem. Wow.
Bethlehem. Do you, I mean, I might have heard that Bethlehem, Pennsylvania exists, but it didn't have like a ring of, when I read Bethlehem, I didn't go, oh, Bethlehem.
I know Bethlehem because of Bethlehem Steel.
Okay. I don't want to know why, you know, let's not even talk about it. Lehigh, UCLA is practically in the Patriot League right now. Lehigh is 0-3. I just saw 0-3 and I didn't even look up again, the teams they lost to. The outcome is anything from uncertain. UCLA will win this game. The big thing will be is whether discerning eyes who know basketball can watch this game and come away and say, given how poorly the opponent is, this UCLA team made some progress in some things that it needed to do. That's the measuring stick for this game. I was kind of mixed on that when I was coming out of the Boston University game, as you could tell by my review. So that's where we are on this. You know, there are a lot of, Dave, what you have not yet, I wrote about it. You have not yet commented really on the basketball game. So the floor is yours. The Boston game, and then that in relation to what we might see tonight.
Well, I kind of agree with most of what you wrote. I think the Sky Clark thing is interesting because I watched the game after kind of all the talk about deflections and everything, because I was watching, I was in the middle of something, so I had to watch it on delay. The deflections did happen. You know, they were there, and he is playing, you know, kind of that type of defense. I do think it's very different from what people who kind of gear themselves around a traditional understanding of what defense should be, should look like. And I think ball pressure and like stopping dribble penetration is going to be an issue for him. He can make up for it if he continues to play passing lanes the way he is and deflecting balls and that sort of stuff. But he needs to maintain that precise level of ball deflection.
Did you hear me scoff? 16 deflections a game to make up for his on-ball defense.
He needs to do a lot of that. Like, it needs to be a lot of that. Because I do think, you know, if you were raised on Ben Hallen defense, it was more of a priority to stay in front of your man, maintain good positional defense, than it was to ever play passing lanes. Cronin has definitely a different philosophy. It's more aggressive and it's more steal oriented. That is better math basketball, but it does kind of leave you open to dribble penetration and three-pointers, which is part of why three-point defense has never been a huge strength of UCLA under Mick Cronin.
I don't think it has to be either or. I think you can still get deflections and steals, but you can still play. It's not – there's an assumption, and I get it, that you're taking risks, so you're getting more deflections and steals, and when you're taking that risk, your on-ball defense isn't as good. Yeah, I see that, but that's not this in this case with Sky Clark. It's not that he's risking that. There are plenty of times when he's not trying to fill a passing lane, and he just is not able to stay in front of his man.
Agreed.
When it comes to Sky Clark, this is what it really comes down to. He's going to, and there are going to have to be matchups in most of these, in most games against good competition, where he's going to be able to stay on the court because he can defend an opposing player. More than likely, the opposing point guard that he can stay in front of most of the time. If he can do that, we haven't seen it. Sky Clark's a good shooter. He's a good offensive player, and we haven't seen it yet. If he can match up against the opposing point guards and play decent defense for 20 minutes a game, then I think he's and just play an average offensive game for him, I think he's a real asset. The issue is where if he gets switched off or somehow he's matched up with bigger guards to defend, that's where his minutes on the floor get questionable for me.
Yeah. And then I would say my bigger issue from that game, and from, you know, if I'm looking for like, okay, this is the five alarm fire for the beginning part of the season, it's turnovers. Got a lot of guys on this team who are sloppy with the ball. Kobe Johnson, maybe chief among them. Great passer, really good vision. Also makes just kind of horrible passes at a kind of alarming rate where it's just really low percentage. Sky Clark only had one turnover in this game, but it was like this screen and roll with Will Kyle where it's just like, why are you giving him the ball at that point on the floor?
Yeah.
What are you
it was even, like at the elbow, right?
Yeah. What are you even doing? He can't do anything with it right there. So why are you passing him the ball? And then he got mad at him and it was just so weird to watch, but Eric Daly, a little sloppy with the ball. Just a lot of that. And if they don't clean that up, it's hard to, and this has been a consistent issue. Right now, UCLA ranks 282nd nationally in turnover rate. I'm just going to say this.
How many D1 teams do we have now? 345? 350?
Okay. I'm just going to say this. No Mick Cronin basketball team is going to be good with a turnover rate that high or anywhere close to that high.
Okay.
It just doesn't work. And he talked about it this week and he said, oh, they're a more pass-oriented team and all that kind of stuff. That really doesn't ring true with the turnovers we're seeing. Like, they are sloppy. You can be a pass-oriented team without like throwing one-handed passes and trying to, you know.
Well, the turnovers off of attempted aggressive passes, I give those I let those go.
No,
100%. Those weren't in this game. There were a few.
There were inbounds turn. Like, there was just slop. I mean, well, that was in New Mexico, but it was just sloppy stuff.
This is the thing about the turnovers, and it goes to our other issue that we talk about a lot. I don't know what the conclusion is, but within Mick Cronin's program, he's a developmental coach. He brings where he's had success are in multi-year guys who learn how to play his style. And that's why they're generally good at not turning the ball over, because they've learned under him for years how not to turn the ball over. If you're bringing in 8 new guys a year, you're not going to benefit from that multi-year training of not turning over the ball. I think they'll improve this year, but I don't think it's going to be one of his better teams in taking care of the ball. There's just too many new guys who haven't been conditioned into taking care of the ball at the level. Kobe Johnson's a good player. He does some things that are not indicative of a Mick Cronin player who Mick has coached for a few years. He's a little weak sometimes and a little lazy, handing off the ball, passing. There are times where you just go, wow, that would not be what a Mick Cronin player who Mick has had for a few years would do.
Yeah.
While I still think Kobe Johnson is a very good player.
And we were talking a little bit yesterday.
Blame it on Annie Enfield.
Well, two things I want to go from there. One is, it's why I asked Cronin this week, is it different trying to train out bad habits from transfers than it is high school? Because you've got a few guys from programs that were bad. You got Kobe Johnson from Andy Enfield and that horrible mess of a team. You've got Sky Clark from bounced to two different programs at one last year that was very poor. And you've got Eric Daly coming from Oklahoma State, where that was a very poor program. Tyler Bilodeau looks well-coached enough, and I think Wayne Tinkle is a good enough coach that I don't think it's affecting nearly.
And one of the things holding back Dominic Harris is he's just not, so far, hasn't been able to play at the standard of what Cronin wants on either side of the ball.
Yeah. So all of that, I think it's training that out of guys. And this is why, like, when we were talking about the strategy, I kept banging the drum. Any version of new players is a problem. It matters if they're transfers versus freshmen, because transfers are more college ready because they've been in college, but you still have to train them to play your brand of college basketball. And so that's why bringing in 8 new guys is can always be kind of fraught. The other thing, and this is maybe more of a macro thing, Cronin, again, he talked about that passing-oriented attack, and the reason he's talking about that is because I think it's becoming apparent to him, and this was kind of the main issue I had coming into the season offensively, is who's the guy who you give the ball to on possessions where you need a bucket up top? It can't be Tyler Bilodeau, because you're not giving him the ball at the top of the perimeter and letting him create. He still needs to receive a pass. Who are you giving the ball to who does not need to receive a pass, who can just take a guy off the dribble and score, or take a guy off the dribble and then kick out for a wide open 3-point shot? That was Jaime Jaquez, Jules Bernard, Johnny Juzang. All those guys could do that. Last year, they really didn't have that guy. The offense suffered. Mick Cronin's offense requires a little bit of that ISO ball that everyone hates to watch.
Second half of last season, though, Dave, was Dylan Andrews, who did do that. Yeah,
to an extent, but a guard is going to have a little bit more of an issue doing everything, because a 6'6", 6'7", guy, he can body up a dude. He can score in a variety of ways that Dylan Andrews has to kind of pick a mid-range shot. Or if he gets a wide open layup, he can do it. But otherwise, it's got to be like a pick and, a 12 footer. But Jaime Jaquez can get to the rack. Jules Bernard can get to the rack. Johnny Juzang can get to the rack. Dylan Andrews isn't getting all the way to the rim and being able to score against size the way those guys can. You need somebody with wing size who can take a guy off the dribble for this offense to really function the way it should. The two guys who are like theoretically candidates in this roster are Kobe Johnson and probably Eric Daly. The problem is Eric Daly, his handle is not at that level yet. It might get there. He might be there by next year, but it's not there yet. And Kobe Johnson just doesn't seem to have the mindset. And also just looking at him physically, he's very athletic. I wouldn't describe him as physically extremely strong. And I think you need to be strong to do this too. And that's a problem with turnovers, because turnovers rise as you pass the ball more. The way Mick Cronin has limited turnovers in the past and done highly efficient offense that, yes, doesn't pass your aesthetic, standards, but highly efficient, is by just keeping the ball in like three guys' hands, letting them create, and maybe doing one pass off their creation in critical moments in big games. They don't have that guy, and they need to develop him.
I generally agree. I'd say, though, where they might find some kind of version of that is in Dylan Andrews, because while he doesn't get to the rack, his mid-range, he can create space and he can hit that mid-range at the same rate as a bigger wing going to the rack. Dylan Andrews, if he's going to be playing Sky Clark, Dylan Andrews is, and you know, what did you say, off guard, that he went, what does that mean? Dylan Andrews is going to be one of your guard wings.
I don't know what off guard means, Tracy. Can you clarify, please?
That's going to be one of your off, I don't want to say off guard, you're one of your off wings guys. That's what Dylan Andrews will play for probably 20.
Everyone's
minutes.
A guard now, Tracy. No one's an off guard or anything. Yeah,
but the coaches call them wings. So
big guards
for a good 20 minutes of this game. So he's going to have to essentially do that. He's going to have to put the ball on the floor, which he does well, find some space, score himself, or come off of that and find someone else for an easier basket off a pick and roll, off of something. I think it's going to be mostly on him. I think for this team to be good, he's going to have to really step up and score.
Yeah.
That's what he did last year, and he shows he can do it. For whatever reason, when we saw him in that inter-squad game, when we saw him so far, including that inter-squad game, he hasn't asserted himself offensively. I think he needs to do that. He has to think of himself as not a point guard, but as a scoring guard.
I would say the other big thing, but this is something I think is going to get corrected pretty quick. They just need to shoot the ball better. They haven't shot it very well from three. They're going to shoot it better. They've got too many good shooters. Dominic Harris isn't going to miss six in a game again.
They're so tight right now. You can just see. And yeah, once they loosen up and they start to feel more comfortable with Cronin on the sideline, they're all better shooters than what we've seen so far.
Yeah, exactly. So I wouldn't get too concerned about that. The turnovers are the big issue. If they can clean that up, and maybe it's a cleanup, or maybe it's what I was talking about, where they need to have a little bit more ISO ball built into their offense and find some guys who can actually do it. Maybe it's Dylan Andrews. But if they can do a little bit of improvement in turnovers and shoot it a little bit better, they're going to see some improvement. But
I think an element of that too, though, I think Trent Perry is going to get better and better. And Trent Perry is a good passer. Yeah. I could see him offering an element to, so we're just talking offense right now, that he offers a whole dimension to it of where he's able to find teammates for easier baskets.
Do you want to know a fun stat?
Yes, all sure.
Right. He hasn't played a ton, but he is first on the team in turnover rate. First. He has turned it over the fewest time in his possessions.
So that's a good sign offensively, that he won't turn it over and he creates for others. So yeah, as he gets better, he will help that offense. So I think that's pretty much where our offense is. I mean, we've got to say Tyler Bilodeau is going to be the go-to guy. He's going to be inside and outside. He's going to be the guy. It was interesting. He matched up against Nelly Jr. Joseph of New Mexico better at 6'9", 6'10" that he matched up against the 7-footer from Boston. So that might be an indication of where he matches up better offensively, but he's going to be the go-to guy on offense. So that's offense. On the other side of the ball, it was an interesting game because they, you know, they extended their ball pressure and then they trapped, and they trapped at different places on the floor. I like it. It forced Boston into 28 turnovers and double digit steals, I think. And that's all good. It's going to be very interesting. You and I have talked about this endlessly, of whether it's sustainable for a number of reasons. Silly fouls. This team is not that highly disciplined. There were, I mean, from Kobe Johnson to Sebastian Mack to, you know, Sky Clark, everyone committing silly fouls when they're trying to pressure too much when they're extending their pressure and trapping, a lot of silly fouls. And then the question is whether that gets them too wound up for offense and gets them so tight on offense, because the big thing right now on offense is how tight they're playing. I know you believe that they will probably settle back into a strong, solid half court.
I've seen nothing from this pressing and trapping to indicate that it's going to work against decent teams.
Okay. So
that's basically where I am. Maybe it improves a lot, but I think you're going to get a lot of false positives, and then they're going to play Washington or Oregon, and they're just going to beat the press literally every time down floor, and they'll scrap it in the first half.
Okay. Because you'd have to say Cronin is taking some of what he's seen so far, I believe, from your interview, as positives that this is working.
I don't see it. I mean, I think Boston is probably the worst team they're going to play this year.
Lehigh.
Okay. Well, they're at least in the conversation. These are two very bad teams.
Yeah.
Look, Cal State Fullerton's no slouch either. They're going to be terrible too.
No slouch as a bad team.
Yeah. Yeah. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. They are a slouch.
The next four, they might turn each of these teams over. Lehigh, Idaho State, Cal State Fullerton, even Southern Utah. They might turn each of them over 20 times. But I'm just not seeing anything from their, like, if you're playing skilled athletic guards who aren't going to panic as soon as they're in a trap, I don't know. They've left a lot of openings for wide open three pointers at the end of these things.
That's why I like the trap when the ball comes across the half line. I like the trap in that at that moment, because now you're working. Now you've got two other sides to the wall that you can use to trap.
And you see that from teams that aren't huge on like pressing the whole way, where they'll trap you in the corner after half court line.
Yeah.
And that's totally fine. I don't mind doing that on a semi more regular basis. But I also think this team is already kind of predisposed to play, like, Kobe Johnson likes to cheat and play passing lanes. You don't need to press when you've got a guy like that. You can just create a certain X number of turnovers from him just jumping a pass up top, you know, three times a game.
I think it would be a great thing to bring out against some Big Ten teams too.
Well, absolutely. Use it in spurts, because he's done that a few times where I can't remember. I think it was Washington a couple of years, or maybe it was Oregon. They had a couple of guards and then they got in foul trouble. And so you bring out the press as soon as they have unskilled guards out there, which I think is the approach to using the press now. I don't think this thing has looked good enough that you can just deploy it against a fully equipped team and a fully equipped real team, not these, you know, cupcakes they're playing, and think you're going to turn them over a ton. I think guards are too good for the most part now.
Yeah. Agreed.
Okay. Well, we've got to get to basketball recruiting, Tracy.
Yeah. I mean, nothing too in depth about basketball recruiting. I've been, you know, watching UCLA basketball recruiting now for a very long time, and we've seen
couple years, right? Two.
Yeah. We've seen how it's, in the last few years, all of college recruiting and college basketball recruiting has changed more than in all the other years that I've been doing this. We've seen Mick Cronin pivot. He pivoted to international recruits that didn't work. Then he pivoted to the transfer portal. The transfer portal is by far a more reliable source to bring in talent. I mean, there's far more talent on this team this year than there was last year, and experienced talent. That, I mean, that's under the heading of talent, experience. So good. That's great. But also, like I wrote a few weeks ago, in the wake of losing on Nicholas Amena, I think there's another slight pivot, and it's an approach to high school recruiting to find the Jalen Clarks, the guys ranked 40 to 70, who will get into your program. And I know you're a huge proponent of this, guys that lend some continuity of how to play for Cronin. I think that's going to be an issue this year. I think this team's going to get a lot better. But when you replace eight, when you bring in eight new guys a year, there's going to be a question of how the element of how much of this team knows what Cronin wants from you in terms of just not effort, toughness. We've seen it in terms of stamina too, but knowing how to play on both sides of the ball. I mean, there's a lot to it. That's important. And going out and finding the guys, the diamonds in the rough in high school that want to come in, play at UCLA, be there for four or maybe even 5 years, learn how to play basketball well, and lend that continuity when those guys become redshirt sophomores or juniors, and what they bring to the program, that kind of develop talent, but that kind of knowledge of the culture is invaluable. So there's that. And then there's just simply use the NIL money. And in this right now, UCLA has proven that it's not recruiting well when it comes to high profile guys, either high school, elite five-star high school guys. And I'd say, you know, even some transfers in the transfer portal last year. You know, someone asked me on the board, why can Kansas and Duke and UConn do it successfully? Well, UConn's won two national championships. Kansas's Bill Self might be the best program pound for pound in the last 10, 15 years of college basketball. Mm-hmm. Duke is Duke. So you can't just do this anymore where you call up a recruit and say, hey, we're UCLA, come play for us. And they're all starry-eyed and they want to run over to Westwood. Or honestly, that they just want to play for Mick Cronin. You know, that those are enough of an attraction to bring in guys. What is the attraction now is NIL. And UCLA has enough. Go out. Don't be shy. Buy into it.
And buy
the guys you need. Yeah. The most obvious to me is Braden Burries. It's a 6'4", five-star guard. He's from Southern California. And like there are parameters for these guys. All of these guys all now have agents, big-time agents, not like little street agents, real, real agents, serious agents. They've got the kind of entourage they have surrounding them, their people, hangers-on, their family, it is a circus nightmare for all of these guys. You want to find one that isn't so bad. These kids can be really talented, but I just don't think they're fits for Mick Cronin. They're going to come in and they're going to be just stunned of what it takes to do well in his program. Braden Burries, I've seen him enough. That dude, he is a tough ass man. I've seen him take over games physically and mentally and just do some things that I'm just so immensely impressed with how tough the kid is. And so you put all that together and then you offer him a big NIL. He's in it. He'll want to stay in LA, probably where his agent is. He's going to have a lot of his people here. That is your advantage. It's not playing at UCLA. It's staying around their agents in Los Angeles. This is the way for UCLA to go going forward. And it's going to take the program to realize we might have to pay a guy $1.5 million. Yeah. And if maybe that, I understand the resistance against it in the last transfer portal. But if you have the money, And you can do this. You can absolutely pay for this. UCLA needs to do it now going forward. That's the way they're going to get their high-end talent. Braden Burry's, like, I look at the 2026 guys, five of the top seven prospects in the country are from California. I know their situations, each one of them. I don't know if anyone is a fit from all those parameters I just listed. Braden Burry's is. And here's the other thing. You don't want another Peyton Watson situation where the five-star kid comes in and they all think they're one and done, and he comes in and he can't play as a freshman, but he's going to leave probably after a year anyway, because that's all in the cards and everyone's figured that in with his agents and everyone else. You want someone who's going to be able to come in and play. For one, I've seen Braden Burry's enough. I've seen this team now. I believe he would come in and start at UCLA next year, whether that's at point guard or whether that's at one of the wing positions, guard wing positions, whether he's playing the traditional two. He can guard threes. He's about 6'4". I've seen him guard 6'6" guys, 6'7" guys, and shut them down. So he can do it all. He's not going to be the Peyton Watson guy where you spend all this money and he's miserable on the bench and all of his entourage and his agents are griping at you and the rest of the country negative recruits you because you didn't play the five-star. This guy's the real deal. More so than the guys in 2026 for me, he's the best fit. So I'd say go all in right now. And if you don't get him, you don't get him. But just at least do what you need to do in NIL. Put out a substantial offer and see what happens.
Yeah, put the word out that we back up. That was a little The Wire reference for you, Tracy.
Yeah, I got it. I didn't really, but I got it with some reference.
Yeah. All right. Well,
we put in good work here, Dave.
We put in great work today. And now, everyone, just wait for, I'll probably put this up in the next half hour. Wait for 6, 7.5 hours, and then all of your sporting dreams will come true.
At the same time.
All right.
I mean, are all of you like, you got it on two different screens? You got that going?
You
got
to double screen it. Yeah. I have to write about football, but even with that, I had the basketball game like on an iPad next to me so yeah. that at stoppages, I was looking over, and then so I wished I hadn't.
I'm writing about basketball, so I can probably cheat over a little bit more for the Washington football game than you would be able to do the other
one. No, it's hard to do it with basketball because you lose the flow.
Yeah, so maybe I can't. Okay. Yeah, this is fun.
Fun times. All right.
Volleyball. Come on. My God. Just take over Poly Pavilion. God.
Come on.
Sorry. All right. Now I'm going to get volleyball fans are going to piss off.
For Tracy Pearson, I'm David Woods, Bruin Report Online. We'll talk to you again next time.